This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
The BC Civil Liberties Association, in a statement to City News, says C2 is a sprawling omnibus bill which would increase the powers of law enforcement agencies that have no civilian oversight, allow police to open Canadians' mail, and subject electronic service providers to secret orders about sharing information with the state, adding that the bill is so broad it could affect people even if they never cross the border. However, Public Safety Minister Gary Anandasangari, a former human rights attorney, says he has no concerns.
I fundamentally believe that we have strike the balance, that while expanding powers in certain instances does have the safeguards and the protections in place to protect individual freedoms and rights.
The public safety minister may believe the government has struck the right balance on Bill C-2, but it seems that that view is shared by fewer and fewer Canadians as they learn more and more about the government's plans. Much of the focus has thus far focused on the creation of a new warrantless information demand power and the expansion of production orders to access information. We've talked about those issues previously on this podcast, and that's part 14 of the bill. But there's also a part 15 that requires closer scrutiny. It focuses on granting law enforcement access to electronic service provider networks, including inspection, oversight, and demands regarding the equipment on those networks. David Fraser is one of Canada's leading privacy lawyers, and he's been sounding the alarm on the implications of those provisions. He joins me on the podcast to talk about the implications of Part 15, aka the Supporting Authorized Access to Information Act, and what it means for network providers and the safety, security, and privacy of Canadians. David, welcome back to the podcast.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
And it was great to have you back. You've been doing some really amazing work on Bill C-2. I've already had some focus on it on this podcast, but while much of the initial focus, I think, in the media and I guess on my podcast has been on, this was part 14, focusing on the information demand power and an expansion on production orders, there is another part, part 15, which raises some major concerns, and you've really been zeroing in on some of these, and I think they're critically important. So why don't we start first with a bit of a general overview? What is part 15 of this bill seeking to do?
Sure. Yeah. So part 15 of Bill C-2, it creates an entirely new statute, and it's called the Supporting Authorized Access to Information Act. And interestingly, part 14 related to the new information demands and production orders came from the Department of Justice, as I understand it. But this part 15 came from the Department of Public Safety, and it was the Minister of Public Safety who introduced the bill. And its general idea is that people who provide services that can be subject to a lawful interceptor or wiretap order under the criminal code should make sure that they have the facilities and the ability to give effect to that order. And they have to be able to get the intercepted communications to the police in a particular way. And on its face, I'm not sure that's unreasonable, but the devil is always in the details. So the Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police have been calling for something like this since at least 1996, now presumably inspired by a similar law in the United States that took effect a couple years before that. And I'm sure we'll talk about Kalea later on. And it's worth noting or keeping in the background that we already have something similar for cellular carriers in Canada. All those cellular carriers are subject to something called the Solicitor General's Enforcement Standards for Lawful Interception of Telecommunications. And so they're already doing this to a certain degree. And a wiretap order currently can also be accompanied by what's called an assistance order, which orders the telco to provide all reasonable assistance to give effect to the wiretap order. But we haven't had a general regime for this for telcos. And we certainly don't have anything that goes after the range of service providers, like the enormous range of service providers potentially caught in the Supporting Authorized Access to Information Act.
Okay, that's a great start. And it really does beg a whole series of questions that I know we're going to come to. You mentioned that the police associations have been talking about this for some time. So as we look back sort of with the framing around the history of lawful access, have we seen these kinds of proposals before in terms of mandatory assistance and the ability to go into networks and deal with some of the kind of surveillance equipment and capabilities that are there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Over the span of the last 20 years, maybe 20 plus, governments have been attempting to change their laws to require kind of mandated intercept capability. And so in 2005, Paul Martin's Liberal government introduced the Modernization of Investigative Techniques Act, which did not pass. 2009, Stephen Harper's Conservative government introduced the Technical Assistance for Law Enforcement in the 21st Century Act, which also did not pass. The Harper government tried again in 2011 with the Investigating and Preventing Criminal Electronic Communications Act, also didn't pass. And then Harper and his minister, Vic Taves, took another kick at the can in 2012 with the Protecting Children from Internet Predators Act, which also didn't pass. And some of your listeners would probably recall the public outcry that I think was responsible for these initiatives being abandoned to die on the parliamentary order paper. And maybe that's some motivation for getting a little bit loud about this as this works its way through Parliament. But in my view, Part 15 of C2 is much more open-ended and wider in scope than what we've seen before. And the scope is essentially undefined. And so there's a real possibility of it being used well beyond the issues that the government says it's all intended to address. And there's the possibility of abuse because it's also vague. And I'm sure we'll get into the vagueness.
Yeah, no, I think we will. You know, you've talked about the breadth. Why don't we dive a little bit into some of those rules? So who does this apply to? You mentioned we already have a system for wireless carriers. How broad is this? I know that it focuses on ESPs, electronic service providers. Can you talk a little bit about that? And then this additional element of core providers that is now included in the bill.
Sure. Probably the heart of my concern about breadth and scope of this is that it applies to electronic service providers, which is incredibly broadly defined in the bill. And so what it says in the bill, it means a person that individually or as part of a group provides an electronic service, including for the purpose of enabling communications. And I'm just a digression. Shouldn't this only be about communications? But it says including. And so if they provide those services to persons in Canada, or if they carry on all or part of its business activities in Canada, they're an electronic service provider. And electronic service is also defined in the bill extremely broadly in a way that goes well beyond kind of traditional telecommunications. So it's a service or a feature of a service that involves the creation, recording, storage, processing, transmission, reception, emission, or making available of information in electronic, digital, blah, blah, blah form. And so it's not just Canadian telcos. So anyone who provides an electronic service that involves information to Canadians is potentially in scope. And so, you know, it can, of course, include Bell, TELUS, and Rogers, the traditional telcos. But I think this interpretation could also include Zoom, Teams, Signal, Telegram, WhatsApp. I think it also covers VPN providers, which is troubling. But it goes beyond communications that we generally understand in terms of being the subject of lawful intercept orders. So it can include Dropbox, include Reddit. It can even include the CBC because their work involves making information available electronically. And that may even scope in your podcast. So that's just dramatically broad. And it distinguishes between what are called core providers and I guess all the other electronic service providers. And who is a core provider is set out in the schedule to the act, which is currently blank, which I find a bit troubling. I think we should understand as it goes through Parliament and we're discussing this and parliamentarians are considering it, who is a core provider? And I expect, and most others expect, that the core providers will be the traditional telcos and the internet service providers like Bell, Rogers, and TELUS. And an additional issue I have with the scope of the bill is the obligations that these ESPs have towards what are called authorized persons. And the way that's defined is also troubling. It means a person having authority under the Criminal Code or the Canadian Security Intelligence Service Act to access information, just to access information. So it makes all peace officers, public officers, and CSIS agents. You'll recall in part 14, there's this broad general authority for police officers, public officers, and others just to ask for and access information. And so that would make all of those people authorized persons. And so it's not limited to people authorized with a court order to access or obtain information. It's incredibly broad. And I don't know if this is a drafting mistake or whether they did it on purpose.
Okay. I mean, that's pretty stunning. It is critical, I think, to be able to have sort of those real use cases to understand who is directly affected by this. And so just to make sure that listeners understand, there are a whole series of new obligations. We'll come to them in just a second, especially around core providers. Yet the government, at least at this stage, isn't even identifying who those are. It's sort of a to be determined, TBD sort of thing.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's rather stunning. And as is the prospect when you start talking about sites like Reddit or the CBC or dare I say, this podcast, the notion that somehow a reasonable reading of how broadly drafted this definition is could include all of those sorts of things goes well beyond what I think anyone would typically expect. Now, you mentioned some of the prospect of who might make these kinds of requests. What are, once we get to those core providers, let's say they are the major telecom and internet providers, what are some of the obligations that they're going to face?
Well, so in some cases, well, in a lot of cases, that we don't know the details. A whole lot is left to regulations. And so Section 5, Sub 2 of the Act empowers the government to create regulations that place obligations on all core providers, which should relate to intercept and access capabilities. But again, it's so broadly and badly written that these obligations could go beyond its purpose, but at least it'll be in regulations, and hopefully we'll be able to see what those are. And the regulations can mandate capabilities to organize and extract information and provide access to this information to those, quote, authorized persons, unquote. And they can mandate the installation of devices on behalf of authorized persons. And importantly, I think this is a good thing, a core provider is not required to comply with the regulation if compliance with that provision would require the provider to introduce a systemic vulnerability in electronic protections. And electronic protections are defined as authentication, encryption, and any other prescribed type of data protection that's related to that service, or to prevent the provider from rectifying such a vulnerability. And so this would permit a regulated core provider to push back or refuse to install a backdoor or to compromise encryption if it would create a systemic vulnerability. And so, as I said, that's good news overall, but systemic vulnerability isn't defined. And the regulations and orders, I think, could prohibit an electronic service provider from implementing, for example, end-to-end encryption or other protections from for their users in the future.
Your read is there's the possibility of blocking the use of end-to-end encryption under some sort of order for various providers. I mean, that's become a core, of course, for certain messaging apps in particular. And it essentially might say, basically, you can't operate in this country unless you remove some of the core functionality that you've built into your products.
Yeah. So the way that I see that working, so if they already have it and removing it would create a systemic vulnerability, then they could push back using this particular provision. But if they don't have it yet, and then become subject to a regulation that says you have to have these capabilities, and if they were then to install end-to-end encryption, and that would undermine that capability, I don't think they'd be able to use it unless they could say the previous state was, in fact, a systemic vulnerability that we're addressing. But ultimately, the decision is going to be made by the minister, perhaps subject to judicial review. But it's kind of, I think the regulations will have the tendency to freeze in place the current kind of security posture of an electronic service provider or a core provider who's subject to these regulations.
Wow. I mean, that's interesting. I mean, it both on the one hand raises the prospect that new entrants can't effectively compete because they can't offer up their customers the kind of security that their competitors are able to. But it then, of course, also raises the question that if you do lock in place the providers that do have, let's say, end-to-end encryption, then the very concern that law enforcement says it's trying to address, or one of the concerns it's trying to address, they acknowledge won't be addressed by this legislation if they're not actually going to touch it.
Yeah, which needs, I think, very close scrutiny. And we need to kind of use our imaginations and think about, well, what are all the permutations and combinations? The government is giving us a number of problems that they say need to be solved. And then putting in place legislation goes well beyond that. And just the scope of it is so dramatically broad, and the potential of what this can do. We really need to look at it kind of clause by clause, case by case, provider by provider.
Yeah, no, which is, of course, going to be a challenge given the way this was introduced as part of an omnibus bill. Yeah. You know, you've mentioned the power the minister has already on a couple of occasions. Can you talk a little bit about some of the power that the minister does have, both in ordering ESP, so not just core providers, but all these electronic service providers to do certain things? How far does it go, and what safeguards are built into the bill?
Well, it goes dramatically broadly, not surprisingly, based on what we've heard so far. So on a case-by-case basis, or I suppose for a broad range of other electronic service providers, the Minister of Public Safety can issue orders related to pretty well the same sorts of things that core providers can be required to do by regulation. And the ESPs have a right to notice in advance and have a right to make representations. But the final say is with the minister, and they can push back because it would be too expensive, but the minister can provide them with compensation. They can say, we're not capable of doing this, and maybe they can be ordered to do it. Big problem is, and I know secrecy is going to be a subject of our conversation, but these orders are secret, including their existence. And I see, so a lot of my practice is cross-border, and I see a real problem in how this reaches outside of Canada. So, for example, as I understand it, it's illegal under U.S. law for an American company to provide access to the content of any communications, regardless of where the person is located, except pursuant to a U.S. federal or state warrant or wiretap order. And that's in something called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and that covers voice, emails, and direct messages. And I don't know if they've fully taken this into account, but I would expect that if they were to issue such an order to WhatsApp or Zoom, those companies would object on that basis. You are ordering us to build in a capability that permits you to cause us to violate U.S. law. And so I'm not sure that they've necessarily thought that through, but certainly if I was one of them, if I was an American company subject to ECPA, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and I were to receive such an order, I would push back on that basis pretty strongly.
Okay, that's super interesting. We're accustomed to thinking about instances where Canadian companies might face essentially the reversal of that. They might face orders, let's say, from a U.S. court that could run afoul of Canadian law. It's interesting to hear that this bill could in a sense do the reverse. You know, you've talked about requirements to assist being one of the obligations that these ESPs could face. You know, what does that mean? What kind of concerns does potential assistance raise out of this bill?
Yeah, it's very broad. And it's problematic because of its breadth. So there's an ability or an obligation on all electronic service providers to provide what's called all reasonable assistance to a range of persons to permit the assessment or testing of any device, equipment, or other thing that may enable an authorized person, broadly defined, of course, to access information. And the list of persons who are authorized to make this demand include the minister, not surprisingly, but you know, any employee of CSIS, police officers, civilian employees of a police force. And of course, this isn't limited to core providers or even ESPs that are already subject to a ministerial order. It could be any ESP. So they get a knock on the door or an email that says, hey, we want to assess your equipment related to our ability to access your customer information. But there's no threshold and there's no limitation on this power. So there's no requirement for example, for approval from the minister or any other senior person. It doesn't even have to be reasonably necessary for any purpose related to the act. So you could have a lineup of people from every municipal police department out the door of an electronic service provider, and that ESP has to provide this unlimited and unbounded assistance. And there's also the ability for the government to make regulations about a whole range of measures, but it includes requirements related to employees of electronic service providers and their contractors. And this can include security clearances and where those employees have to be located. And again, this isn't limited. So by regulation, the government can say that the janitors at an ESP have to have security clearances, which amounts to kind of essentially approval by the Canadian government. And in theory, they can make regulations requiring, for example, Chinese-owned WeChat to have a data center and personnel in Canada and to have all those personnel with Canadian security clearances. That's kind of inconceivable. But again, this power is pretty unbounded as it was written in the bill.
Wow. The breadth is really pretty stunning. One of the concerns that you talked about on your YouTube channel, which really caught my attention, was the focus on prohibitions on disclosure. And, you know, we've already seen that in other elements of the bill. We see it in C-26 now, Bill C-8, in terms of restrictions on disclosure. Can you talk a little bit about how those play out and some of the impact that they might have?
Yeah, and some of that, like, I can see a justification from a security point of view, but again, it's relatively unlimited and unbounded with respect to just the secrecy that's being imposed. So ESPs cannot disclose the content of a ministerial order, but they can't even disclose whether they're the subject of a ministerial order. And if they've had any communications with the minister related to the orders or the representations that they might have made before, they can't disclose the contents of that or any other information that could be set out in regulation so they can add to this list. But the thing that's most troubling within the list of things that they're not able to disclose is that all ESPs, not just the ones subject to orders, but all ESPs will be prohibited from disclosing, quote, information related to a systemic vulnerability or potential systemic vulnerability in electronic protections employed by that electronic service provider. And when you dig into it, like in my view, it's not only bonkers, but it will actively harm Canadians. So this would mean that if any electronic service provider were to discover a vulnerability into their system, they would be prohibited by Canadian law from disclosing it to anyone. So they couldn't disclose it to their customers who may have been affected by it, by a past or a current vulnerability. It may include their own contractors who carry out security audits on their systems. And, you know, on a daily basis, hundreds, if not thousands of cybersecurity professionals look for vulnerabilities. They fix them and they share the information with the rest of the cybersecurity community so that these vulnerabilities can be addressed across the ecosystem and around the world. And it's frankly shocking that this would be included to prohibit that sort of disclosure. And just like a final note on this sort of secrecy, it's been reported that the UK government has recently served what's called a technical capability notice on Apple under the UK equivalent of this bill. And that technical capability notice would require Apple to remove end-to-end encryption on iCloud. And this reportedly, because Apple can't talk, this reportedly is not limited to UK customers. And Apple can't say anything about it. And Apple can't even tell the US government so that it could maybe be resolved on a government-to-government basis. And it's been reported that Apple is seeking review of the order, but that's also a secret process. So you have orders that affect the security of information for millions of people, and none of the innocent customers who are looking to have their data safeguarded can hear about it. And I think that is deeply, deeply problematic.
Oh, it's enormously problematic. And, you know, one of the things that's kind of remarkable about it is that we, of course, as you well know, have laws dealing with security breach disclosure requirements. And so when you pair these up, it's as if you can't talk about vulnerabilities. You can only tell people after they've been affected and they may have suffered a security breach and their information may have been put at risk. So you can't tell them that at the time when they might actually be able to take steps to try to deal with some of those potential vulnerabilities, only after they've essentially been victimized by some of these kinds of concerns.
Yeah, anybody who's been involved in cybersecurity incident response knows how important it is to the world, to everybody who uses any kind of electronics, that there are people who are looking for vulnerabilities and are addressing them and are fixing them and are reporting them to the right authorities. There are government agencies in Canada and in the United States who want to hear about these sorts of things so that they can protect government systems. And there's all sorts of information sharing and organizations within the private sector that, you know, confidentially share information about a vulnerability that they discover so that it can be fixed. Now, governments, I think, generally want to exploit them as much as they want to fix them. But this seems so completely unrelated to what we've been told is the purpose of this proposed act, that I'm just kind of almost flabbergasted in terms of, did they intend to do this? And why would anybody intend to do this?
Yeah, no, it's very surprising to say the least. Such a wide range of reforms and requirements that touch on so many different players begs the question, how is any of this enforced, or what is the enforcement mechanisms that are envisioned by this bill?
Well, I suppose it wouldn't be a Canadian regulatory scheme if it wasn't subject to overreaching inspection powers, administrative monetary penalties, and then potential offenses. And so the Act gives the minister authority to designate enforcement persons who get, not surprisingly, vast powers under Section 19 to enter any place other than a dwelling, to verify compliance or to prevent noncompliance with the Act. And it's not limited to places actually used by ESPs. It's just any place where they think there could be information that's relevant. So it's any place other than a dwelling, but they can get a warrant to enter a dwelling, but that seems really unlikely that would be necessary to enter a dwelling or that a judge would authorize it. But so once they're in a place, they're authorized to examine anything. They're authorized to make copies of any information they find there. They're authorized to access any information they can when they're there. They can remove any documents, use any computer or data processing system in the place. And then anyone who happens to be in the place is required to give all assistance that's reasonably required by the designated person, including providing any document or electronic data that the designated person may reasonably require. And again, it's not limited to actually ensuring in compliance with the Act. So it's completely without limits. And it theoretically could mean that the designated person can go into a major telco and say, I want your entire customer database, or I want Michael Geist's phone records, and the ESP ostensibly needs to comply. And even more, it would be illegal. So it'd be an offense for an employee there to not assist with such an outrageous demand. And the government says that this is usual for regulatory oversight, you know, just like fisheries inspectors who can go into a fish plant and count the halibut. But I think this is qualitatively different than that. You know, by definition, an electronic service provider is the custodian of very sensitive information of its customers. And all of those customers, whether they're good guys or bad guys, and the majority will be good guys, have a charter-protected right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure. And so I think that this triggers Section 8 in a way that, you know, wouldn't come up in a fish plant. But they've put it out there. And we saw the same sort of inspection powers in a few bills in the last parliament that had the same implications for sensitive customer information, which included the Online Harms Bill and Bill C-26, the cybersecurity bill that you mentioned. And then these designated people can also issue orders related to compliance with the Act, which, of course, are mandatory. And so, which leads to, if you violate the Act or you violate an order, this can be pursued by administrative means, so administrative monetary penalties, or AMPs, as we call them, or as offenses. And there's some difference between the two. So for an AMP, the penalty can be up to $250,000 per day that the violation continues. And that's essentially the designated person kind of writes the organization a ticket and sets up the basis. And that can be challenged through an administrative process. But directors and officers can also be personally liable. But if it's pursued as an offense, the penalty can be up to $500,000 per day. But that's on a higher standard. That's on the offense standard related to beyond a reasonable doubt. And so the threshold for proof is much higher. And so I think that's the lower threshold of proof and the lack of charter protections is the reason why they would want to go through the AMP regime as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, you've mentioned the situation in the UK. We talked, you had a brief reference to CALEA in the United States. Can you talk about how all of this compares with what we see taking place elsewhere? That's one of the first sort of responses that you often get from journalists or politicians who want to know your perspective on some of these issues and say, well, how does what we're thinking about here in Canada compare to what we find elsewhere?
Yeah, you often hear them say, well, all of our Five Eyes partners are doing this, or kind of under their breath, are similarly violating the rights of their citizens. So in this particular scheme, so I mentioned that I think the Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police were inspired by what was happening in the US when they started kind of calling for this sort of thing. And so CALEA, or the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, has been the law in the US since 1994. And, you know, the UK, I mentioned the Apple case, the UK has a similar law that I think goes even further. But it's challenging to do like a real comparison because so much is left to the regulations in Bill C-2. So the US one has been operationalized since 1994 and has been modernized a number of times. We don't know what C-2, what Part 15 of C-2 is going to look like when it's finally passed, if it is, please don't, and we see regulations. But essentially, CALEA says that telecommunications carriers and manufacturers of telecommunications equipment have to modify and design their equipment, facilities, and services to make sure that they have built-in capabilities for targeted surveillance. So that's allowing law enforcement and national security folks to selectively wiretap any communications traffic, which includes internet traffic and voice over IP traffic. And so the capabilities essentially mean that the telco needs to be able to retransmit the communications in real time to the police. And so the police present the telco with a wiretap order, so a Title III order in the US for a particular customer or phone number. And that phone company needs to transmit all of the communications to and from that customer or phone number to the requesting agency electronically, so remotely. So you don't have law enforcement on the telco's premises that are attaching like little alligator clips like they used to in the 1960s. Now everything's all digital and they can send it, but it's supposed to be based on receiving a proper order. And that access is supposed to be managed by the telco. And of course they're compelled to do it pursuant to the wiretap order. But, you know, there are issues with this. So it was reported in 2024 by the Wall Street Journal and others that China-backed hackers, and this is referred to as the Salt Typhoon incident, that these hackers had exploited this capability to obtain call and text message metadata and actual calls and voicemails of government officials and political figures. And it's reported that they were able to exploit the CALEA-mandated equipment across a range of telcos, and presumably because they all had to have the same equipment and they all had to have the same capabilities dictated by the US government, they all had the same vulnerability that could be, or the same backdoor, if you want to call it that, that could be exploited by these experienced hackers. And, you know, like, bad guys are very clever. And you would expect that they would try to exploit any of these systems and capabilities if they were installed in Canada.
Yeah. No, that's, you know, the irony that that legislation designed to increase our security and safety may actually result in increasing some of our vulnerabilities, and then keeping those vulnerabilities secret from us is rather incredible to see that that's what may be the result of this legislation. So there are a lot of concerns here. I guess just to wrap up, you know, what do you expect to see going forward? You know, I don't think we've heard a lot really from providers, either domestic or foreign. It's been more civil liberties groups and some academics that have been speaking out, at least initially, although I suppose it's still early days. Do you have a sense of where to from here?
So I think with respect to service provider responses, I think you're right that it is early days, that I certainly know a number of organizations that are kind of still working through this and still trying to figure out exactly what it means and what it has the potential to mean. And so, you know, as I said, you have the traditional telcos are already subject to the Solicitor General's enforcement standards. So they're already doing something like this for their cellular services. And I would expect that, you know, most traditional telcos in Canada already have the capability to respond to lawful intercept orders and orders for metadata. If you look at those that do have transparency reports, you know that they do these things on a regular basis. But I think they should be concerned about the scope creep and inspectors getting into their business. And I think they should also be concerned about the government dictating exactly how they're going to do it and introducing kind of a salt typhoon vulnerability into a system. I think currently they get to decide how they do that. That's going to change after this. And I know that the non-telcos that I've spoken to, you know, they're very concerned, particularly those who are headquartered outside of Canada. But I think there's still a fair amount of digesting. The fact that Parliament has risen and this isn't going to likely go to committee until probably later in the fall, or it can't go to committee until at least September, that there's an opportunity for people to reflect on it and think about it. And I would imagine there's a fair amount of stuff that's happening behind the scenes in terms of discussions with senior government people. Related to you know, what sort of changes or what sort of appetite there may be. And I know that there was a call for hiving off Part 14 and Part 15 from the rest of the bill. And, you know, one final thing that I'd note, and you mentioned, well, this is a border bill. You know, so this was the first bill introduced by the new Mark Carney government after its election. And it's not surprising that the strong borders part would be a priority given all the headlines about fentanyl and human trafficking and all of that. But I don't recall hearing anything about lawful access during the election, like not a peep. Like, this did not seem to be a priority, and certainly not the sort of thing that one would put in their very first bill. And I suspect that what became Part 15 of this bill has been in the drawer of a senior bureaucrat at the Department of Public Safety for some time, just waiting for another bill that they could credibly bolt it onto. And so in 2012, it was online predators going after children. And in 2025, it's somehow related to strong borders. And I think we're going to hear a lot of people calling for parts 14 and 15 to be removed from C2. I would want to see each put in its own bill so they can each be discussed fully. And the government will be forced to try to credibly defend it.
So I think what took everyone by surprise, and in some ways, you know, if there's been a bit of a slow reaction at times from some, it may just come from the fact that I don't think anybody really saw this coming.
But I think the quick reaction from civil society, I think, is really important, because I think it was the loud critics from civil society groups that led to the abandonment of this, these initiatives in the previous instances. And I think that civil society really need to be given credit for that in the past. And I'm glad to see them jumping on it right now with informed critique about the what are the very real problems in both Part 14 and Part 15.
Yeah, and so am I. I think we're in total agreement here. And I'm grateful certainly for the work you've been doing. Your YouTube channel on these issues has been absolutely stellar. So thank you for that. And thank you for joining me here on the podcast.
It's always a pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBitesPod, or follow Michael Geist @MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.